Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China. In this program, we'll look at books, ideas, new research, intellectual currents, and cultural trends that can help us better understand what's happening in China's politics, foreign relations, economics, and society. Join me each week for in-depth conversations that shed more light and bring less heat to the way we think and talk about China. Seneca is supported this year by the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a national resource center for the study of East Asia. The Seneca podcast will remain free, but if you work for an organization that believes in what I am doing with the podcast, please consider lending your support, just as the University of Wisconsin-Madison has. You can get me at senecapod@gmail.com. And listeners, please support my work on Substack at seneca.substack.com. There you will find, in addition to this podcast, the complete transcript of the show, a weekly essay from me, and now a wide range of offerings. James Carter's This Week in China's History column, Paul French's Ultimate China Bookshelf, Andrew Methvin's Chinese Phrase of the Week, and the outstanding China Global South podcast, and a weekly essay from the brilliant and deeply informed folks at the China Global South Project. This week on Seneca, we're talking about the state of Chinese understanding of the United States, how China's strategic class, its senior analysts in academia and in think tanks within its decision-making organs among its media elites, how that class assesses what's happened across the last two decades or so in the U.S.-China relationship, what it focuses on as it diagnoses what brought on the worsening relationship, and what it would prescribe for how the relationship can be improved, if it indeed can be. I am delighted to be joined by Da Wei, one of China's foremost scholars of China's foreign relations and especially relations with the U.S. Da Wei is the senior director of the Center for International Security and Strategy, CISS, at Tsinghua University in Beijing, and is a professor in the Department of International Relations in the School of Social Science at Tsinghua. Before September 2017, Professor Da served as the director of the Institute of American Studies at the China Institutes of Contemporary International Relations, KICR, CICIR, a leading think tank in Beijing. He was at KICR for more than two decades and directed the Institute of American Studies from 2013 to 2017. Professor Da, welcome to Seneca.
Yes, thank you, Kaiser, for inviting me. That's really my great honor and the privilege to join you.
Really, it is entirely my honor and my privilege, but thank you so much. Professor Da, you have just returned only 2 days ago to Beijing after wrapping up a few months, I think, as a visiting China Studies Fellow at the Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center and at the Freeman Spogli Institute, both at Stanford University. Listeners will recall that very recently I spoke with a gentleman from both of those same affiliations, Tom Fingar. So tell me, Da Wei, did anything surprise you, either positively or otherwise, about your time at Stanford, about attitudes you heard when it comes to the U.S.-China relationship?
I won't say it surprised me a lot, but I think at least it verified some of my beliefs that the United States is a country has, you know, different, I will say, very diversified view towards China. And I think, of course, Stanford, or let's say the West Coast, I think is quite different from the East Coast, particularly, for instance, Washington, D.C., so-called inside the Beltway. I think they're very different. And also, I think there in the, I think in the West Coast first, I think it's more or less, it's more about, for example, people cares about economy, technology, but less about politics. And China, of course, is a background of a lot of discussion. But at the same time, I won't say China is very much a focus of the discussion. China is more or less a background. So not so many people really cares about China or talking about China. Yeah, that's something I think is quite different, you know, comparing my experience in D.C. China has been a kind of focus, I will say. So in Stanford, I'm very glad that they have really good experts on China per se. I mean, China's politics, even, you know, local grassroots level politics, rural development, Chinese economy, culture, arts. I think that's, you know, very good, very interesting expertise there in the West Coast and particularly at Stanford.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, it's not national security 24/7, right? It's not. It's good to hear. And even when they are talking about technology, it's not just talking about technology competition with China. It's I couldn't agree with you more. Even though, you know, the Freeman Spogli Institute is right next door to the Hoover Institute, they're very different worlds there. So I'm very curious about how you would characterize the difference between the world of academic think tanks in the U.S., which you've had quite a bit of exposure to now, and China, if that's something that you've had maybe time to process in the short time since your return. How would you characterize the difference in the culture there, or the work style?
I will say, of course, there are a lot of differences, but one thing I have been thinking about in past several months, not only in past 3 months at Stanford, actually, I resumed my visits to the United States since last year. So I traveled to the U.S. a few times last year, and this year I spent this a quarter there in the United States. So I'm observing the difference between the two countries, particularly the two strategic communities in two countries. I think one of the things I want to emphasize, I also talked to that to some of my colleagues here in China, is I will say, yes, this is a this bilateral relations is in a quite difficult, let's say, competitive, sometimes confrontational status. But I will say in the U.S., I think China is one of the problem, or one of the topic, one of the issue people are discussing. For example, this is election year in the United States. I think for the people, ordinary people, I think domestic issues like immigration, like inflation, I think those issues are more important than foreign policy. While when discussing foreign policy, I think Ukraine, the Middle East is more urgent than China. So China is maybe, as I said, a background, or I will say China is one of the problem, but it's not the only focus. While in China, I will say the U.S. probably is first, is you know, even among ordinary people, you know, people really cares about the U.S. or China-U.S. relations very much. If you take a taxi in Beijing, if you talk to an old man, old woman, have physical exercise in the park in the morning, I mean, everybody are talking about China-U.S. relations, this competition, if the U.S. is trying to contain China. And even in the strategic community, I think no matter your focus is international relations or not, or even among the IR scholar, no matter your expertise is the U.S. or not, everybody just focus on China-U.S. relations. I think this is very much different. Sometimes I say the U.S. is like, in Chinese, we say qian shou guan yin, a Buddha with southern hands. So probably the U.S. is dealing with different issues, you know, at the same time. Maybe they use, they have 1,000 hands, but they use maybe 100 hands managing China-related issue, but there's still other 900 hands doing other things. But China, probably we don't have so many hands. I don't know, maybe we have 500 hands, but we probably used 300 of hands out of those 500 dealing with or managing China-US relations. So this is very different, I think, between the two countries.
No, that's very insightful, and it's absolutely true. Often I use the sort of New York and Chicago comparison. You know, Chicagoans often know exactly everything that's happening in New York. New Yorkers don't give anything. Couldn't care less sometimes about Chicago. That first and second city relationship.
Yes. Actually, this difference has some policy implication, I will say.
Oh, yeah.
If China focuses on the U.S. very much, or if you focus on this China-U.S. confrontation very much, I think it will have bigger influence on China's economic policy, on China's education policy, on China's technological innovation policy. I think everything, I won't say everything, but a lot of those policies will revolving around this China-U.S. competition or confrontation. In the U.S., I think I don't think that's true. I think their education policy and their economic policy, they are revolving around their own problem, their own, maybe domestic challenges or other things. But I mean, China is only one element of these policies in the United States. But in China, it's very much focused on this. So I have a concern that maybe too much focus on China-U.S. competition in China will distort the policy here in Beijing. So I really hope we can feel a little bit relaxed in dealing with China-U.S. relations. If you focus too much on it, kind of U.S. or U.S.-China competition addiction, if you have this addiction, I think you will have a distortion of the policy in every regard. I think that's not good in China's interest.
It's comforting to hear you say that you find that the United States isn't so single-mindedly focused on China. Sometimes on the East Coast where I live, it feels like it is single-mindedly focused. It feels sometimes like it is the organizing principle of, hostility toward China. Sometimes it feels like you can't pass any legislation without making it about China. But I'm glad to hear you say this. So as you said, it is an election year. How well do you think your colleagues understand the intricacies of American politics? How well do they appreciate the extent to which things, as you say, in American domestic politics that are seemingly completely unrelated to foreign policy or to China do end up affecting how the administration or Congress shapes China policy? After all, I'm sure that, the old pattern of presidential candidates criticizing China very sharply while on the campaign trail and then actually governing in a very different way, taking a much more pragmatic approach once in office, is a very familiar pattern. We've seen this for a very long time. But it's different now, I sense. A lot of people would say so. I'm wondering about your own peers in the Chinese strategic community. Do they assume that the old rules still sort of hold, or have things fundamentally changed?
I will say, based on my observation, most scholars and probably some of the officials, they still worry about the potential so-called scapegoating of China on the campaign trail. I think this is still one of the things that first people believe is happening, or if it's not happening, it's going to happen. So I don't know if that belief is correct or not, to be honest. But my observation is, as I said earlier, just now I said, currently at least, I don't think China is the top, I would say top three issues on this campaign trail, but we don't know. Maybe it was something bad happened. Who knows? Some crisis happened, then suddenly China again become kind of topic. And another thing is, even if, let's say, China is not on the, will not be the top topic of the, on the campaign trail, but China is a background. China is always there, right? It's, when they talk about, economic policy, EV, sober pillow, those kind of technological innovation, China's still over there. It's still a background. And no matter how much China is debated or mentioned during the campaign, this outcome of the campaign is still very important for for U.S. policy to China, to, you know, I mean, two candidates obviously have very different approach to China. So we are watching quite closely to this election in the United States, not only about what they, I mean, the two candidates, what do they say about China, but about their, what is their policy agenda? What are they advocating for once they win their second term? So I don't know, maybe the model that you mentioned, like criticizing China, then later become practical. This model, I think it's over. No matter, I think no matter they talk about China or not on the campaign trail, I think they will be tough on China, no matter it's Republican or Democrats who win the election. But I think this is a consensus in the United States that the next administration will have a pretty tough policy on China. The difference is just the approach or the area. In which area should the U.S. be tough? Or with what is the most effective approach to be tough on China? I think this may be relatively silent during the campaign trail, while a consensus of being tough on China after the election. I think this is I won't say it's a model, but this is happening and maybe will happen in the upcoming election, I guess.
So what are the prevailing theories among the more sophisticated members of the strategic class there in Beijing and in other major cities about why and how things got to this current state, to the point where there is this palpable level, not just not outright hostility yet, but there's certainly a lot of negative sentiment in both directions. So when your colleagues, again, your more sophisticated colleagues, when they talk about this, where do they lay blame? What inflection points do they point to? I'm wondering whether it's the same as people here in the U.S. whose ideas I'm very familiar with.
I think here in China, I think the mainstream view say the reason of this deterioration of the bilateral relations is the narrowing gap of China and the United States. I think this is the mainstream view, not only among scholars. I think this is kind of consensus in China, that as China and the U.S. getting closer in terms of their, let's say, comprehensive power or economic size of the economy or technological or military capability, I mean, the U.S., then many people here believe that the U.S. is going to keep China down, to prevent China from surpassing the United States. I think this is the most widely accepted argument in China. At the same time, some other people may say, besides this narrowing power gap thing, the direction of China's development and the expectation of the U.S. differed. I mean, very, very different. U.S. expected in 1990s and maybe in the first decade of this century, I think the mainstream view in the United States expected China to become, I would say, a country more like the U.S., maybe not a liberal democracy, but maybe politically more competitive, economically, market-oriented economy, and socially maybe more pluralistic, and foreign policy to be a supporter of the existing order rather than revisionist or even revolutionary. So I think in past 10 years in the U.S., there is a growing consensus that China is moving towards another direction, opposite to what the U.S. had expected. So I think these are the perception here in Beijing, I will say the mainstream view here, to explain this deterioration, different development direction, and also narrowing power gaps between the two countries. But of course, there are some people also blaming, for example, leaders, political leaders, like they say, a lot of them criticizing President Trump for his policy, trade war, and those, and also some people around in his team, and some other people criticize President Biden. But I will say the previous explanation. I mean, in China we call it structural reasons, sure, explanation. That is more prevailing viewpoints in China.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised. I guess I want to drill down a little bit and ask, why do they think China moved in this direction that would ultimately disappoint the United States? In other words, why did China, while in the entire period from roughly 2001 to 2010, let's say, was moving in a direction of more, maybe not super competitive politics, but at least at some level, you had, you know, more competitive politics, a more, if not pluralistic, at least a more tolerant society. You had, you know, maybe a more responsive, a sense of a more responsive government. Most people would say, you know, there was a more vibrant sort of public sphere, more tolerance for more independent civil society during that decade. What do Chinese people think is the reason for the change that was palpable by 2009, right after the financial crisis? What do they think it was? Do they point to any American actions, or do they point to anything that was happening domestically in China to shift China's trajectory?
I will say it's primarily because China's domestic reason for China's success and China's failure both caused those all problems. I would say success and problems or challenges caused this change in past 10 years. I will say, for example, on the challenge or problem part, after three decades of fast economic development, China did face a lot of domestic challenges like corruption, for example, or pollution, for example, or social disparity. I think those issues, and we have other things like some people feel less confident about the political system in China and even to their own Chinese culture. So Chinese government and many people in the society, not only the government, I mean, many people among the elite think China need to concentrate power to be more effective and then to fight against the corruption, to push for more reform, and also dealing with the social challenges like disparity and other things. So those are the challenge part. And for success part, I mean, in those 30 years, China achieved a lot of, you know, particularly economic success. So particularly the younger generation, they feel quite confident about China. So China is a successful story. So there must be something good in China, or you cannot explain this successful story of China's economic development. So then it become China's, later officially it become China's, in Chinese we say 四个自信, the four confidences in China, right? You are confident in China's theory, path, model, or culture. I mean, yeah, many people are become more and more self-confident about China, and some of them become more patriotic. Then you can also say some of them become more nationalistic because of China's success. So again, no matter it's, we should attribute that to China's success or China's challenge, I think China's the Chinese society, including Chinese leadership, reached a point maybe about 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Say China need to move towards a more concentrated power, and China need to emphasize its own, you know, characteristic and its own system, its own institution. So this is something good and this is something necessary. So I think 15 years ago, this is kind of consensus in China. Then China started to move towards that direction. But of course, today, after 15 years ago, some people may like today's status. Some people may, you know, disappointed about today's situation. But I mean, back to 15 years ago, I would say that's a consensus. We think we need this kind of reform. Again, I don't know. People are now have different opinions. I mean,
of course,
different people have different opinions.
What's striking to me is that what you've just said parallels so much, especially when you talk about the need for sort of a reconcentration of political authority. Susan Shirk's argument in her excellent book Overreach, which I've talked to her about on this program. So,
yeah,
really, really interesting. I guess I have been worried since October 7th, 2022, especially when the serious restrictions on semiconductor exports and other related export bans came into effect, that many, if not indeed most Chinese of the strategic class are now, as you suggested, many aren't quite convinced that irrespective of who is in the White House, irrespective of which party controls the House of Representatives or the Senate, it doesn't matter that the U.S. policy is fundamentally aimed at keeping China down, thwarting its emergence as a genuine multidimensional peer competitor that has comprehensive power, as you say, that is truly on par with the U.S. Are there still people in China, in the think tanks, in the strategic community that we're talking about, in influential positions, who still think that this isn't necessarily the case, who still have a more optimistic view of American intentions, or at least one that says there is still a significant difference between the two political parties?
I will say, of course, people here still believe the two parties in the United States have differences. At least if today when with Biden administration, the two countries at least successfully stabilized the relationship a little bit, right? And the Biden administration is more or less more, I will say, predictable than his predecessor. So even though sometimes the Biden administration is going to make some very negative policy against China, usually it won't surprise China too much.
Right.
It's something we already expected several, I will say, maybe 1 year ago, at least 6 months ago. So less surprise, more predictability. And we hope some people, I think the Biden administration say this, they say this is what they are doing is, I think they focus on how to make the U.S. more competitive. So it focuses more on the U.S. per se, rather than to keep China down. This is what the Biden administration is talking about. I'm not fully convinced by this, but I mean, at least the Biden administration say we want to live together, coexist with China, and this is a competitive coexistence, and we will not change you. We cannot change you. So you will decide your own path. But we will strengthen our own power, our own capabilities. Secondly, we will try to prevent China to harm our interest. So this is what the Biden administration are talking. This is very much different from, let's say, Trump administration's policy, particularly during the year 2020, after the COVID-19 broke.
Right.
So that will say that in that year, that's kind of, the Trump administration have kind of, I call it regime change policy. So
right.
It's, directing at China's political system regime. So I think that's very much different. So I will say, and it's not only I myself, I mean, many people here still believe the two parties, the two administrations are different. Of course, the common place is that both of them have kind of strategic competition policy. From China's perspective, this is very negative to China. But I will say these are two different negative approach.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know which one is better, but I'm quite sure which one is more predictable.
You've written recently about this. You call this Sullivanism, after, of course, our national security advisor, Jake Sullivan.
Yeah.
And you've compared it to Trumpism as these two sort of foreign policies of the two administrations. But you've rooted these ideas, you say, in American domestic politics, which I thought was really interesting, specifically in the severe polarization of the American electorate, the rise of populism, and the accompanying rejection of neoliberalism and of globalism, this wave of anti-globalism. I should note that I actually read excerpts from this in translation from Thomas Desgarrett Geddes, who writes an excellent newsletter on Substack called Sinification, which I would really highly recommend. Anyway, thank you, Thomas, for that. Can you elaborate on this idea? What is Sullivanism as a foreign policy doctrine? What is its connection to the fact of polarization, to anti-neoliberalism, to anti-globalization? And what are its parallels and what are its points of departure from Trumpism?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to elaborate my points a little bit. So I want to start from the earlier question, why these bilateral relations is getting worse. I explained just now at least two school of thoughts in China. The mainstream view is about, I said it was structural views, right? Power gap and ideology thing. And another more, I will say, entertaining school of thought is about the personalities, about the presidents, right? So besides those two explanations, I have my own explanation of this deterioration. I think in past 10 years, both China and the United States are undergoing a very important domestic change. It's not necessarily related to the other side, or it's not necessarily all about the other side. I mean, China changed its own policy not because the U.S., well, the U.S. changed its policy not just because China. China has been part of that.
Sure, the China shock, right.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what is that change? I say during 1980s, 1990s, and the first decade of this century, I mean, the whole world, basically, we embrace the so-called neoliberalism. So we put economic efficiency at the top priority, and all governments put the economic welfare as the most important task to achieve. So all the countries, all the government want to achieve this economic development and try to pursue economic efficiency. So globalization, interdependence, this become the most something that you have to embrace. You with the globalization and interdependence, you know, different countries can use their own comparative advantage. So China and the U.S. had become kind of natural match. You know,
right.
The one biggest developed world, the other is the biggest developing world. So they really a match. So that explained the relatively stable, good time of China-U.S. relations in those three decades. But as I said earlier, China faced a lot of problem after three decades of development. And of course, we also achieved some success and we have some problems. So China wants to solve those problems, social disparity, corruption, and pollution. And the U.S. and the West, I will say, after the financial crisis, realized that they have their own domestic issue to deal with. Or similarly, social disparity, right?
Right.
And like unemployment, so and other issues. Anyway, so I think this is what Jake Sullivan talked. I think last year he gave a speech about
foreign policy for the middle class. Right?
Yeah, exactly. So maybe the economic welfare is not the top priority. Also, it's still very important. But there are other parallel goals. And economic efficiency is good, but national security. What about national security? National security is also important. So I think in the U.S., people began to securitize a lot of things. And the COVID make a lot of people also have concern that relying on one country like China on supply chain could be dangerous if something bad happened. So, I mean, security concern now has risen to some status. So economic efficiency and interdependence, globalization is not the necessary choice. Even in the U.S., I will say globalization, free trade becomes some bad words. So in China, right. It's still very welcome in China, but in the U.S. and probably in the developed world, it's not so welcomed. So in first three decades after 1980s, China and the U.S. face-to-face, we hug each other, we embrace each other. But in past 10 years, we turn away, both countries turn around, and we back-to-back. So our economic ties, social ties weakened. I think this is, you know, what I said about Sullivanism, I mean, a doctrine of Sullivan, I will say. So put the security agenda, I will say, not ahead of economic development, but maybe as equally important goal as the economic development. So there are other goals. So then focus more on domestic issues like employment, like economic security, and also technological security. I mean, focus more on that. In China, I think similar thing is happening too. So for me, this deterioration of these bilateral relations is something, given those background, I mean, it's something inevitable. It's something, you know, even if China is not, you know, catching up with the United States in terms of its size of economy, even if we have totally different political leaders in two countries, probably the ties between the two countries, particularly the economic ties, will weaken. And that will bring other geopolitical outcomes. So this is what I try to argue in my article you mentioned. Thank you for mentioning that.
So I think that I tend, of course, to also buy into a lot of these structural arguments, a lot of the domestic political drivers I appreciate. But when I've spoken to Chinese diplomats, either on or off the record, in the most candid conversations, they have tended to try to ascribe the sorts of this downturn and especially the negative impressions that Americans increasingly have toward China, not to these structural things, but more toward a failure of understanding, misunderstanding somehow of China, its inability to communicate well, to its failure to, you know, 讲好中国的故事. They attribute much of the difficulty for China in its foreign relations to discourse power. You know, they say, you know, 中国缺乏话语权, the dominance of the American-led West and its narrative because of this powerful media. Some even talk about cognitive warfare against China. What do you make of this idea, these sort of superstructural elements to it? Do you think there's anything to that?
I personally don't think in that way. I will say, of course, this misunderstanding, misperception, or the power of discourse, let's say, 话语权, power or narrative war, this kind of thing, that's important, I will say. And it's true. It's true that I think the West or the United States, many people in the United States don't understand China very accurately. That's true. But that is also happening in China. I mean, how many, you know, how do we understand the United States very accurately?
Right, right.
Yeah, probably also a lot of misunderstanding or misperception, if not more.
Absolutely.
Of course, yeah. After COVID, I mean, this people-to-people tie is growing, and it will be helpful to let people talk to each other in person and also travel to the other side to see. That will be helpful. But I won't attribute all those problems to this misunderstanding and misperception. Do we really have misunderstanding and misperception? To be honest, I doubt it. I mean, what is happening in China, people like us, do we totally misunderstand what is happening in the United States? I don't think so. I think, those political polarity, all social, disputes and economic, like inflation, immigration, we know those problems. And we know that there are some other bright side of the United States. The economy is pretty good. Technological innovation is good. I think we understand this. This is my understanding, and I think this is correct. I have been correct, not wrong. So maybe in the details or some nuance, yeah, not accurate. I think we need to do more more communication. I think it's same to my American colleagues. Do they fundamentally misunderstood China's direction or what is happening in China? I don't think so. I will say both sides, maybe we understand the other side's general direction, the general status. I think all those understandings are true, are correct. Maybe 10% of misunderstanding, misperception, if without that, we can have even more accurate picture of understanding of the other side. But I will say this is a 10% thing. We already got 90% correct.
I hope that's the case, but still in the United States and in China both, there are people within this class, people who, have made a life of studying the other country, who nevertheless find themselves in profound disagreement with one another within this country. For example, there are plenty of people on the very, very hawkish side of the aisle, including people who are very well versed in China, who speak the language, who understand it well, and others, I would include myself in them, who are, very much on the more dovish side of the spectrum. The same is true in China. I know this to be true. There are people who are quite hawkish toward the United States. You know, a lot of people who fancy themselves IR realists are very, very hawkish. This goes not just from the think tanks down, but into society. You wander onto any Chinese social media and you see, a very, very vociferous disagreement. So, I think It's funny. I think maybe in aggregate, yeah, there's a pretty good understanding of one another. But maybe I hope that those people on either side inhabit just that 10% that you're talking about. But more important than communicating with each other often is the ability to communicate upward to the leadership in some way. Give me a sense of how, or if at all, the analysis that comes out of CISS or Kicker, how it makes its way up the food chain, as it were, who, hopefully even to the desk of Xi Jinping himself or to influential people around him. Are there maybe examples of policies that you believe really originated with China's think tanks and came to be implemented at the top level?
I think China has improved its decision-making process in past 10 years in this regard. The think tank university, or more broadly intellectual community's involvement, participation in this policy-making process has increased dramatically. So for think tanks like us, like CIS or my previous employer, Kicker, I think one of our jobs is to provide policy analysis and recommendation for the government agencies or, you know, policy circle. So usually our policy can reach to some level. Of course, we cannot decide it. We don't know. Sometimes we don't know to which level it reached. But we do have regular channel to provide our analysis for the decision makers. I don't know if they listen to us or not. Maybe they just threw it into trash. That's possible. But at least we have that channel. And also our government always, you know, very frequently invited us to go to their office for policy consulting on very, you know, frequent, I would say, not daily basis, but weekly or monthly basis. You will have opportunity to have this kind of discussion with government official, and before they initiate any major policy thing or after something big happened like the San Francisco summit. They will ask us for our advice, and after that they will brief us for, you know, what had happened. So this, I think, is a good side of the China's policy making process in past 10 years. For the examples, I, you know, to be honest, sometimes it's quite ambiguous, vague at the top level. We don't know, and also sometimes when, let's say, for example, a very big. Policy, for example, China-US try to stabilize this bilateral relations. This is a big thing. Or some other even bigger, like let's say Belt and Road Initiative. Many people input their thoughts in it, so it's hard to tell which part is yours, which part is theirs. But I can say, you know, one of the example was last year. Because we at the university, we have our track two channels with, for example, during this Ukraine war. So we have our dialogues, we have interlocutors both in Russia and in Ukraine. So we talk to both sides of separately. But I think China is at a position that we can really talk to two sides. And we try to help our government to better understanding the situation. So last year, before President Xi Jinping called President Zelensky of Ukraine, the foreign ministry invited me to join their press conference. I think, for me, it's quite unusual because usually press conference is for diplomats. It's for spokesperson role. Yeah, they should at that podium. But I don't know why. But maybe I think it's because I and also some other scholars, we participate in this policy-making process, then the government, MFA, appreciate our role. So they invited three scholars. I was one of those three scholars. So we went to the Lanting, the Blue Hall of the MFA. So sitting with our spokesperson, Wang Wenbin, and others, so hosting the foreign press and answer their question. So I think this is the way that the MFA show their appreciation to scholars' participation and contribution to the policy-making process. But of course, I don't know the detail, which one of my recommendations has been taken by them. They won't tell me, right? This is the secret. But obviously, they appreciate our participation. So that's why we were there.
Well, I hear there's an opening, a very senior opening at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Maybe they'll tap you for it. That would really help the world quite a bit. So, Professor Da, there is a concept that I've always tried to place at the center of the way that I think about China, and which I've always encouraged others to value and to embrace, and that's the concept of cognitive empathy, which you might know better as, you know, strategic empathy in the IR field, but it's basically the same idea that we must try to understand how our counterparts, whether that's, you know, a partner or a competitor or an adversary, even, yeah, how they see the situation, how they interpret our behavior. I've often found it to be lacking in American discourse on China, though there are some people for whom I think it's really second nature. It's wonderful to see. And it's one of the things that I think separates the good analysts from the bad ones. And I always found you to be just an exemplar, somebody who really has that ability. I don't know if you remember, but at one point I had you on. It was a closed-door conversation. It was a private conversation, but it was about the U.S., China, and the Taiwan issue. And I started the conversation by asking you and the American gentleman who participated in it to articulate in good faith the position of the other side. So I asked you to say, what is the American position on Taiwan? And, you know, what are the things that inform that? I thought you did a marvelous job of that. And I thought it really... when I do that a lot, and it sets the tone, I think. It makes for a more productive conversation. Do you think that within China, there is a good understanding of the American process, but what about the understanding of the American perspective? Like, can they inhabit American values, American assumptions about the world, American sort of habits of mind, so that they can feel how Chinese rhetoric, how Chinese policy, how Chinese behavior must look from the Washington side? Do you think that the Chinese strategic class is good at that?
Yeah, first of all, I want to say thank you for, you know, this cognitive empathy. And also, I remember the, you know, that closed door discussion on Taiwan. Actually, I learned from you on that term. So after that, I think in that discussion, you also mentioned this cognitive empathy. So, and I use that in my classroom now.
Oh,
I tell my students, you need to, I want to cultivate your cognitive, sometimes I say intellectual empathy.
Yeah.
I think this is, yeah, so I really need to thank you. This is a wonderful, great term. And I will say back to a question, I think actually in both countries, I would say, both in China and the United States, there are some people who really understand the other side's position accurately. Yeah. But the challenge is, are they in the position of policy-making process? Or even if they understand the other side, but once they were put on that position, do they still have room, space to use that understanding, that empathy? I think this is something challenging in both countries, I will say. So talking to the, like, I spent this quarter in Stanford, I think they have good experts, really know China well. And I think we also, in China, we also similarly, we have a lot of good experts on China. Sometimes we, last year, I also participated in some, the track two dialogues with American colleagues, American think tanks. On some issues, I cannot be too detailed about those topics, but on some topics, and then we try to write down, just as what you said, we try to write down for the other side their positions and their potential response after something happened. And I think both sides did pretty good job.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, yeah. But the problem is, we discussed this today, in both countries, I think security becomes something more important. So once that happened, everything will be securitized. If something becomes security, if something is becoming national security, you know, the room for this cognitive empathy will be much, much narrowed. I will say squeezed. You don't have the luxury to utilize this empathy, and it could become politically incorrect in everywhere, I mean, in both countries.
Yeah.
So, I don't worry about the lack of the empathy or understanding of the other side, but I really worry about the securitization of the policymaking process that will make this empathy, you know, this cognitive empathy in a very difficult situation, you can never utilize it.
I don't know if you saw, Zhang Ming wrote an essay about his worry about the pan-securitization on the Chinese side as well. This is something I'm constantly railing against here on the American side. I mean, I just as you do, I believe that national security is one important lens, but there are many others that we also need to have in our toolkit when we look at any problem. And so, yeah, I think that's a very serious issue. I'm curious. I'm really glad to hear that your students are now being exposed to this concept. So when you talk to them, do you sense that they grasp the idea of cognitive empathy pretty easily and they're able to I mean, I think that's wonderful to hear. I can't tell you how flattered I am.
Yeah. Again, I brought your idea into my classroom, and I try. For example, I teach a class on a course on China-U.S. relations. So I actually that's a class. I have students from different countries, including Americans, but most are Chinese. But I have some students from Korea, Japan,
great.
Malaysia, different countries, Russia, Ukraine. So. I mean, I try to force them to understand the other side's position. So I basically, sometimes I invite American teachers to my classroom too. I mean, I also push my American colleague. I said, don't say something good. Please say something harsh.
Mm.
Let my Chinese students to understand why. But I think the core here is let my Chinese students understand why some American think in that way. That could be wrong. I mean, their perception, their understanding could be wrong, could be harmful for two sides, but we need to understand why, what they are thinking and why do they think in that
precisely.
Way. And I'm also forcing my foreign students to understand, China's policy. I ask them to read, and I ask them to debate. And my final examination every semester is to, for the Chinese students, I give them an assignment. I say, you need to write a speech. You are going to have a speech in the U.S. think tank. Your audience are all, Americans, American experts.
Brilliant.
So you are a Chinese professor. You need to address to them. So you need to show me your speech. You understand the other side's concern. And then based on that, how can you address this concern? I think this is the way that I evaluate your speech. And for the Americans, I have the same thing. You need to address to Chinese audience. First, you need to show me what are the Chinese concerns to the American side. Then based on this acknowledgement, how will you address these concerns to Chinese audience? I think I won't say it's an easy job for them because it's, for the students, they need to read a lot.
Yeah.
They need to read a lot. They need to, and they also need to force themselves to change their, long-time holding viewpoints, right?
That's right.
This is quite challenging. So I won't expect I can solve the issue just within one semester, just we meet once a week. So, but I hope this can be a starting point to let them to think, critically, and let them to put their put their feet in the other side's shoes. I think this is the key, the purpose of my course.
Oh, that's fantastic. I mean, it is difficult and it does require a lot of reading and a lot of exposure. That's why, as you use this phrase, intellectual empathy, I've used the word informed empathy. It's the same idea that it isn't natural. It isn't just your basic emotional empathy. It's a very different type of skill. And it doesn't occur naturally. You need to cultivate it. Yeah, absolutely. One area where I wonder whether China has cultivated it enough when it comes to the U.S. is understanding how China's position since February 24th, 2022, since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, how that looks to Americans. This is one of the things I have the most difficulty in trying to get. I try to tell them, look, it's sort of a kind of a situation. I mean, where they both feel excluded on the outside and they huddle together for warmth. But, this is a big stumbling block to any meaningful improvement of the relationship, as you know full well. Can you talk about the Chinese perspective on Russia, as you understand it, your own assessment of what it would take for Beijing to alter its stance in this conflict enough to at least ameliorate the U.S. and its concerns.
Yeah, I think you already described the situation quite accurately. I think China, I would say, many Chinese sympathize Russia very much because they, I think the two countries, both countries experienced this kind of, you know, I won't say maybe exclusion is a too strong word. China is not being, has not been excluded. China was, has right. been integrated. But we feel, I think both countries has felt a kind of pressure from the West in past 30 years. I think this is a long-existing pressure, and sometimes it's heavier, sometimes it's maybe not so serious. But, I mean, the Russians always talking about this NATO expansion thing. Well, in China, you know, we have U.S. Several U.S. allies in our region, and we have Taiwan issue, we have other issues. And when China tried to make contribution to the international existing international order by setting up the AIIB, Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, or tried to set up the mechanism like Shanghai Cooperation Organization, basically it's being rejected by at least by the United States.
Right.
So we feel that when we want to make more contribution to the existing international order, the West or the United States try to keep China out. So you are not qualified because you are not a liberal democracy. Only we can do that. You cannot do that. So that kind of pressure, I will say, make Chinese, a lot of Chinese feel, I will say mainstream Chinese sympathize Russia a lot. But to be honest, I don't think many Chinese really believe that Russia have the right to invade another sovereign country. Yeah, Chinese government probably cannot say that, but I will say if you talk to Chinese privately, I will say most of them will say, yes, we sympathize Russia very much, but it, does that equal to the right to invading the other sovereign state? I think the answer is no. China is a country suffered from, you know, invasion and from the Western imperialist country for a century. So we are quite sensitive to this sovereignty and the territory integrity thing. So China, I think China is in an awkward situation. I mean, both sides, no matter Russia and Ukraine, are our friends. So how to balance this? This is really, really challenging for China. So again, back to your question, I think Chinese sympathize Russia. And also Russia, I forgot to mention that China, Russia is our probably the most important neighbor. Yeah. We have very long borders and also to some extent the economic partner. So I mean, China really want a peaceful neighbor, a peaceful borderland with Russia. So those are all the reasons that China feel reluctant to be tough on Russia. But that does not mean China really support a civil invasion to any sovereign country.
Right. I've been trying to explain to people that every time, even if you look at that 12-point position paper they put out, any mention of territorial integrity and national sovereignty is meant as a mild rebuke to Russia, right? I mean, it's...
And also, actually, China put that as number one in those
right.
12 points.
That's right. Yes. It's too subtle, I think, for most Americans to understand that that's what it's intended to be. Yes. But, you know, when you had like Zhang Jun talking about, you know, the massacre, the war crime in Bucha in the first months after the invasion and calling for an supporting calls for an investigation, that was meant as a rebuke, you know, preventing overflights of Aeroflot, you know, planes. That was meant as a rebuke. All these things, but they don't add up to much in the eyes of most people. And I mean, the phrase that's caught on with a lot of people is that they call it a pro-Russian neutrality that Beijing has invented. But yeah, that's a gigantic stumbling block. As you know, I mean, as you've said already, we were talking about this, how the bilateral relationship, you know, it's part of the conversation, no matter what area of the world you're working on. The Europeanists who work at Kicker or at CISS, the, you know, people who work on the Global South, all of these things. There's always this subtext of the United States, ASEAN. I'm sure they're looking at that survey that just came out and thinking about this, because the shadow of America is always there. Help us to understand how, I mean, because the listeners, I think, I'm not sure they understand how Beijing thinks about its relationship with these other regions with the middle powers included, how that the U.S. is constantly haunting that relationship. And for example, I look at how the dynamic may have changed after October 7th of last year with such a groundswell of criticism against Israel, so many nations of the global South now, you know, does China understand this as some sort of strategic opportunity? Do they see this as a way to realize that long cherished dream of seeing, you know, more strategic autonomy on the part of the EU? How are they thinking about the global context when it comes to U.S.-China relations?
Yes, particularly those scholars, I mean, researchers, they talked a lot about it. In China's context, sometimes we say it's the third party thing, third party issue. Yeah. So in China-U.S. relations, you still have very important third parties like Europe. Like actually, Russia is also third party. Northeast Asian countries like Japan, Korea. So obviously, basically, several groups. First is Europe. Second is Russia. Third one is the Northeast Asian countries, Japan, Korea. So the fourth group is ASEAN country. The fifth may be India. And the sixth, I would say, the Global South. I would say those are the six major third party in China-U.S. relations. So theoretically, I think this is already a consensus in China. We believe that this third party is extremely important for China. One of the reasons is because the U.S. want to, to some extent, isolate China. So actually, it's not only in China-U.S. decoupling. I think it's kind of China decouple. I think the U.S. is pushing for kind of China's decouple with the rest of the world.
Right.
So China-EU decoupling, China, you know, ASEAN decoupling, if that happened, that will be China's big problem. So what I think the mainstream view here is, so long as our relations with at least certain of third parties, maybe not all the, it will be great if we have great relations with all the third parties, that will be great. But at least we cannot lose all the third parties to the other side. I mean, it's not about winning them from the U.S. It's not choosing side. But I think the goal is to keep them, to try to encourage them to keep balance. That's enough for China. So I think now I will say, for example, ASEAN country, you were mentioned that that report, the recent survey by the Indonesia, by the Singaporean Institute of Southeast Asian Studies. I mean, the ASEAN country, Southeast Asian country, is a very obvious place that China and the United States reach some kind of balance there. I think that's something good for China. I don't expect China can just monopolize that region. It's impossible. And those countries, I mean, the ASEAN countries really need the United States to balance China, but probably vice versa. So if so, that's okay. Our goal is not to win the whole world to isolate the United States. This is not China's goal. Our goal is to prevent China to be isolated by the world. So we work with all those countries. I think we recognize this importance of the third party. The challenge is how can you really maintain a good relations with them? Like, for example, Europe. As we said, that so long as the Ukraine war is fighting, it's really hard for China to maintain a very constructive relations with European countries.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right? But let's say if our position is supported or liked by European countries, probably we'll lose Russian.
Yeah.
So that's quite, it's a dilemma, I will say. And on the Middle East part, I will say, probably China's position is, first, I don't think China's position is decided by this calculation about winning other supporter, winning over other supporter. I think China naturally feel we are tied with the Palestinian people. I think this is China's long time position from 1950s, 1960s till now. China feel, you know, linked, tied with the Palestinian people. We supported them. No matter what was the incentive, China's position, I think, at least is more welcomed than welcomed in the global South, as you mentioned. But have that position, I think that position also explained why in the survey in the Southeast Asian countries, China is Now I think more people like in Indonesia and Malaysia,
both majority Muslim countries.
Yeah, they show some kind of supportive policy attitude to China. While we also need to pay our cost. I mean, Israel is not happy with China's position. Obviously, I have many friends in Israel. They are not happy at all about China's policy.
No, indeed.
And some people in the United States maybe is not happy about China's position. This is a trade-off, So I think what China can do is just stick to your long-time value and your principle. I think in this case, in the Middle East conflict, sticking to your long-time, long-standing position of supporting Palestinian people's, fight for their liberation, while at the same time also oppose any violence against the civilians. I think these two principles are extremely important for China to dealing with this crisis in the Middle East.
Very good. Let's move to another difficult topic. When I read the work of many American policymakers, analysts, journalists, pundits, a majority of them look at the Taiwan issue and the fact that it now looms so much larger in the American consciousness today, the fact that there's so much more discussion in the U.S. about the possibility of actually a shooting war, of a military move on Beijing's part, conflict between the U.S. and China. No doubt that is all happening, sure, but they attribute this move in this deterioration over Taiwan and the rising importance of it in the American consciousness. They attribute it to moves by Beijing. They say that it's Beijing that has changed the status quo, that China has become more aggressive. That granted, there is a small minority who would take the opposite position, who would say that in fact it's the U.S. that's done more and acted first to change the status quo. But what would you identify as the reasons behind this heightened sense within the American strategic class of this crisis over Taiwan? What happened? This isn't all just because of Trump's phone call or Nancy Pelosi's visit. Part of it is, obviously, but...
Yeah, I think on Taiwan issue, you mentioned a very important term, status quo. And the U.S., one of the U.S. policy, long-time policy, has been opposing any side to unilaterally change the status quo. But what the question here is, what is a status quo? How to define a status quo? So from China's perspective, let me say that I can give you two examples. In 1972, in the Shanghai Communique, when President Nixon visited China and the two countries signed the joint communique, that was the first joint communique between China and the United States. So in that document, the U.S. side stated that the U.S. side acknowledged that the Chinese on the both sides of the street believe there is only one China and Taiwan is part of China. So for us, that was the status quo. I mean, both sides, across the street, believe we belong to one China. And another case is in early 2000, during Bush administration, when Chen Shui-bian was in power in Taiwan, China and the United States worked together to opposing Chen Shui-bian's pro-independent actions. So I think that was the first time the U.S. side, I think it's from President Bush 43, from him, he said we oppose the unilateral change of the status quo. What he referred to, what he aimed at, was Chen Shui-bian's action. I mean, the status quo was... both China, mainland China, and Taiwan believe the two sides belong to one China. This is the one China principle. And we believe that the Taiwan authority has been changing that position, continuously in past 30 years. So status quo is not about military activity. It's not about how many missiles China have aiming at Taiwan, or how can China's airplane cross the midline, or so-called ADIZ of Taiwan Strait. This is not the status quo, because this military status quo will be changed every day, because the power of the three parties is changing every day. How can you keep a status quo? China's economy is growing, then China's military budget is growing. China's military capability is growing. How can China keep a status quo in that regard? So the status quo is not about military presence or military, activity. It's about the legal status of Taiwan. It's about the Taiwan, if China is part of Taiwan, the Taiwan is part of China. I mean, this is what we define a status quo. So from this perspective, first, we think Taiwan Authority has been changing the status quo. Secondly, we believe that the U.S. has been hollowing out its long-time One China policy. The U.S. have the One China policy. It still have that One China policy. But the content of this One China policy has changed a lot. So we think the U.S. side is hollowing out the status quo. So that's the reason why we believe it's the U.S. or the Taiwan Authority is changing the status quo. But again, I know I understand how American side or Taiwan Authority define the status quo. So we have this difference. But I think I need to say it publicly. Actually, I hope our American listeners can understand the difference here. It's not China is going to change the status quo and to invade the island. You know, now even the U.S. government officials publicly say China has no plan to invade Taiwan before 2027. I think they tried to clarify that. I really hope someone can come out and give me an apology. So many people in the West talking about, I mean, if you check the medias, including some officials, in past 3-4 years talking about so-called 2027, but is there anybody who can take this responsibility, who can be responsible, say, oh, I'm sorry, I was wrong. On this very sensitive issue, I said something fundamentally wrong.
Well, it was one naval officer who said that in some sort of testimony.
I don't want to mention his name. That's a very senior officer. But I mean, they are U.S. government-appointed officer or government officials. U.S. taxpayers are paying money for them, and they are building, they are maintaining the U.S. military capability while saying those irresponsible remarks on very sensitive issues. Then after 2 years, 3 years, just say, dismiss, I don't think China have that intention. China just want to have that capability. Yo, give me a break. So anybody, I mean, this is so important, so sensitive issue. All sides need to be careful. All sides need to be careful. Yeah, this is what I want to say. Yeah, I'm sorry for this. You know, I'm a little bit.
I asked you the question, and you gave me a very full answer. But of course, from the Taiwanese perspective, it seems like that definition of the status quo forecloses the possibility that the Taiwan Authority can democratically elect any party except for the Kuomintang.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that would seem to be the logical conclusion of this insistence. So, of course, there's going to be this sense that...
I mean, yes, I fully respect our compatriot in Taiwan, their right to vote their officials. I mean, China has never said you cannot do that. I mean, they just have their own election just in January, right? Very peacefully,
right.
Very peacefully. So they can do that. But the problem is, if you want to pursue a policy of independence, then that will cause the trouble because we also need to respect the public opinion here in the mainland. The 1.4 billion people here, basically, this is part of China. And the most of the country in the world also recognize that's part of China. And on Taiwan side, they have their own constitution, right? They have their own constitution. So they are electing their leader, a leader under that constitution. That constitution is the One China constitution. So it's not us, you know, changing the status quo. It's the other side. I mean, if you choose your president or your officials, that's your business. How do you run your manage your economy, your politics? That's I think our compatriot in Taiwan. That's their power. I have no different opinion on that. But I think if you want to change the legal status of the island, if you want to change the constitution, you need to understand this is how dangerous this could be for the bilateral, for the cross-strait relations that could lead to a war, a military conflict. We don't want that happen. Who want a war? I mean, and the popular, the prevailing war is, view is China want to launch a war. And do we really, are we so crazy to like a war? Nobody like a war, right? It's particularly right. If there is a war, that will be a war over the Chinese territory. Yeah. Why should we do that?
Global economic suicide.
We have no reason to do that. So don't force China to do that.
Let's move on to a happier topic. You have been a very strong advocate for better people-to-people ties, scholarly exchange, scientific, cultural, educational exchange, all of this and more. I am also an advocate of all these things. But I'm curious to hear your reasons for advocating it. What is the mechanism by which building goodwill at the interpersonal level affects the political relationship at a government-to-government level? Because I assume you believe there is some transmission that somehow that this is foundational to a better political relationship.
Actually, I don't think the close people-to-people tie will lead to a good relations. But again, this back to our earlier discussion about empathy, intellectual, empathy issue. Mm-hmm. If we know, if two officials or if two researchers, they know each other really well, and particularly when they have personal ties on the other side, they will know that the other side is not crazy, right? I mean, the other side is a reasonable player, and they have their own, the people on the other side, they have their own, values, they have their own history, they have their love, they have their hates. I mean, they are just ordinary people like us. If we stop demonize the other side, if we view the other side as, as normal people as we are, then I think we won't go to a very radical policy. We don't, sometimes if you view the other side as just a completely different creature from ourselves, probably we will pursue some very, very radical and crazy policy. So I think this tie, people-to-people tie, maybe it won't solve the problem of this nomadic competition or confrontation, but at least it will limit our policy within this boundary with the limits. It's a policy of human being, right? It's not something is there.
Right.
I think this is something, the bottom line of the two sides, and the people-to-people tie can play that role. And I hope because I teach in Tsinghua University, so my students, I think most of them will have very bright future. They are really top top students in China. So probably they will, 20 years, say 30 years later, they will become kind of leaders in different areas in China, even internationally. So I hope when they are young, I can cultivate this sense of intellectual empathy. So one day they become leader, when they make policy, they won't make big mistake. They won't make any, unhuman policy. I think this is something for me quite important. So I'm really committed to that.
That's wonderful. One last question for you before we move to recommendations. Throughout your career, you have interacted with so many different scholars and policymakers, students, people in the Chinese Foreign Ministry, both on the Chinese side and in the U.S. Could you share one instance or one experience that you feel profoundly influenced your understanding of the relationship, perhaps changed your perspective on a really important issue in the relationship?
I always talk what happened last summer. It's not one of my friends, I always call him Woody. He's not a scholar. I won't call him a scholar. He was a veteran. He was a soldier served in Vietnam with late Secretary of State Alex Haig. Yeah. So he's also a kind of advocate for people to people, military to military ties. So last summer, I brought my students with me to the United States as a delegation. We have 14 students. So Woody lived in Philadelphia. He's kind of retired with his wife. So he treated us a dinner for the whole delegation. So he was so I mean, his attitude was so genuine. He's so friendly to my students, and they held a really nice banquet, you know, put very nice food on the table and gifts to the students, and put the two national flags on the table. Then he stood up and say something to my students and ask them questions. The atmosphere was so touching that he also, because that was my, you know, I saw him for the first time after 5 years. So one of my two, I think one or two of my students, young ladies, they were moved to tears.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, for Woody's, you know, very touching, friendly attitude to them. Though he's in his 70s, he talked to those young men and women very friendly, cordially. So when I saw those tears on the face of my students, I was really moved. You know, I think this is the force, this is the strength of people-to-people ties. Sometimes we say people-to-people tie is soft. Or sometimes we say emotion is something very soft. But at that moment, I realized it's not. It's really tough. You know, I mean, this is the strongest force between the two countries that can link, you know, two peoples and the different generations, so that he can would pass his affection to China to my students. And then my students realize that the American peoples are so friendly to them. So American peoples are just as lovely as their fellow Chinese. So we are ordinary people. We can love each other. We can help each other. I think that moment really planted the seed of friendship in my students' heart. I think that's really, for me, it's also learning process. It's really, really, really wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm. What a beautiful story.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing that. My God. And thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me to publish this interview. I think it'll really, really resonate with so many of the listeners. All right. Well, let me move on to recommendations. First, a very quick thank you to the great folks at the University of Wisconsin-Madison who are helping to keep the show going with their generous support this year. It takes me part of the way to making this a viable enterprise, but I am still far, far from being able to keep doing it at this rate. So please do consider supporting my work by becoming a paying subscriber to the Seneca podcast and to the Seneca Substack. Substack is where you can find the newsletter and all sorts of wonderful goodies. It's seneca.substack.com. I know that you'll find it worthwhile. All right, let's move on to recommendations. Dawei, what do you have for us?
Can I recommend a few? I mean, not only one thing. You ask me this.
Absolutely. Go as many as you like.
I think I have one book to recommend and I have one CD album, and I have a cinema. Three things, movie, I mean.
Oh, great.
For the book, I really loved, this is, you know, I read it in my 20s. So that's Owen Stone's book about Van Gogh's life, the painter. It's called The Lust for Life.
That's a
biography of Van Gogh, which I will say changed my whole life. I read it when I was in college. So for the CD album, I'm a fan of Bach, so I like cello very much. So I think Pablo Casals, the uncompleted cello suite of Johann Sebastian Bach, is something I kept on, you know, listening, you know, repeatedly almost every day. So the movie I love and I watch for 20 times, I will say two movies maybe. One is Cinema Paradiso.
Oh yeah, wonderful film.
Yeah, I love that movie. And I also love American movie Forrest Gump very much.
Yeah, Forrest Gump, great movie. I love Tom Hanks.
Yeah, I think that's a history of contemporary the United States, American history. So I always let my students to watch. I recommend that to my students. So those are my recommendations for you today.
Good old Agan. Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, Agan Zhengzhuan. 还有天堂影院. Yes.
Oh, wonderful. Great recommendations all. For me, for the past several months, I've been rewatching the television show The Sopranos with my son Johnny, who is 18. And we were only, I think, maybe four episodes into the second season. At that point, he started asking me all these questions about the food they were eating, because they're always, you know, there's strange dialect. They use this sort of Italian-American kind of New Jersey way from Sicilians and Southern Italians and Neapolitan. Yes. And so he got online, he found this Sopranos family cookbook, and he asked if he could buy it. And then what we do now is we have a great tradition where on the weekends we will watch an episode or two together while we eat a dish that he's picked. And so far I've done eight or 10 different dishes out of this cookbook, and they've all been really, really good. Now, it's a particular type of Italian-American food. It won't be for everyone, but I really quite enjoy it. It pairs so well with watching the show. And many times now we've been eating the exact same food that comes up in the show, which is really great. So, I mean, the basic Sunday gravy.
That's good.
Yeah, it's really fun. So the Sopranos Family Cookbook is my recommendation. And rewatching The Sopranos, which is still just as great as you remember.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you once again, Professor Da. And just what a pleasure it was to talk to you, and what an honor.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's my great pleasure. And I look forward to meeting you this summer in Beijing, maybe.
We will, I hope. You've been listening to the Cynical Podcast. The show is produced, recorded, engineered, edited, and mastered by me, Kaiser Guo. Support the show through Substack at cynica.substack.com, where there is a growing offering of terrific original China-related writing and audio, or email me at cynicapod@gmail.com if you have ideas on how you can help out. And don't forget to review the show on Apple Podcasts. This really helps people discover it. Enormous gratitude to the University of Wisconsin-Madison Center for East Asian Studies for supporting the show this year. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.